Mike's here. Welcome, Mike. I feel like I often have conversations with people that are struggling with what it means to believe or to have faith. Lots of different categories. But if I was going to kind of try to break those categories down or group them together a little bit for my own clarity of thought, I'd say that I talk with some people that want to believe, but they don't feel like they're doing all that well with it. I talk to people that think because of what I do, because of some of my occupations and vocations, that I must be some kind of faith super person. Nobody that really knows me ever has this conversation with me, but relative strangers sometimes do. And they think there's some sort of standard, some sort of external standard to measure up to, and that they don't or can't. And then I feel like I have lots of conversations these days with people that would say they used to believe, that have given up, and for a variety of reasons and with a variety of emotions. That's kind of been the preponderance of them in the last few years, it feels like. And I find all of them interesting, but I find it particularly intriguing how many people seem to think that believing in God is binary. That believing in God is an either or, and that there's some kind of a quantifiable measure of faith that you have to be a believer. That there's some sort of, again, external measurable standard that says you got to measure this mark to be the thing that is called a person of faith or a believing person. And the other thing that I find interesting is how in our time, lots of folks want to be spiritual, which is lovely, but many of those people want to be spiritual without really believing in anything in particular, which rather takes the meaningfulness out of belief, for me, at any rate. It's a little bit like the old folks saying about how if you aim at nothing, you're really likely to hit it. And it's sort of spirituality without belief with some particularity, something to push against, to pull against, to rail against, for that matter, doesn't feel especially meaningful or helpful. And the other thing that's occurred to me kind of early in my reflection about this is that I know I'm a guy who likes to think out loud. I like to work things out by talking about them. It drives my poor wife crazy. And I'm a preacher to boot, and so it's tempting for me to try to talk myself and other people into believing. And I've learned that it just really doesn't work that way. We were kind of tidying up on Sunday. Davis's grad was this weekend, and so we hosted this gathering. Homeschoolers and grads, it's kind of this curious thing. But we just had this wonderful, wonderful afternoon and evening with about 40 friends. It's a big cross-section of ages and stages, and it was really lovely. And made a huge, enormous mess of the backyard, as you can imagine. So Sunday was cleanup day. And so we were tidying up, and all of a sudden this guy that I know who lives out in the country near us kind of shows up in his coveralls and rubber boots, and with his 9-year-old daughter in tow. And Taya, our youngest, is 8. They've met on one other occasion, and he was just coming over, bringing his daughter just to see if her and Taya could get together and play. He was popping by. Lovely. We were in the middle of things, and we still had out-of-town guests, and so it wasn't the right occasion, but when I thought about it later, I thought that's more like what it's like if we think about bringing someone toward faith, or even bringing ourselves toward faith. I think it's more like that. Because this guy could talk to his daughter about friendship until he's blue, He could describe it, he could rhapsodize about it, he could say how it's changed his life, he could illustrate it and go on. And in the end, if he wants her to possibly be friends with my daughter, what he really needs to do is arrange a meeting and then stand back and see if a friendship forms. And once he arranges the meeting, it's out of his hands. It really is. And I think faith is like that. Belief is like that. We can talk about faith till we're exhausted, until everyone's had more than enough of the conversation and have nothing happen. But in the end, what we can do is arrange a meeting where a friendship might occur, and then it's no longer in our hands. And my hope about these gatherings, among other things, and these lovely occasions that I have in my life to enjoy just time having coffee and conversation with people, is that they could be something like that, more like the kind of arranged meetings, one place where that kind of an encounter might occur. And I know, having kind of grown up religious, I know that this kind of arranged meeting is not Not only is it not the only one, but it's not even the best one for lots of people. It's way too religious. It just is. We've been doing something like this, most of us, for most of our lives, and we don't know how to undo the worst of it very well or really auger into the best of it. We're learning, and that's awesome. But for somebody for whom this sort of an experience or an encounter was a foreign thing, it's a real reach. That's not a reason to not have that arranged meeting. It's just a way to think about the limits of it that might be helpful. And I don't know, any of you have ever had occasion to be brought into a social situation where you're the stranger, you're the newcomer, and you're brought into that situation by somebody who's socially skillful. And I mean, this is a lovely experience if you've ever had it. This is a real skill set. And to be taken into a room of strangers and introduced to people and made welcome by somebody who has kind of made it part of their mission in that experience to do that for you and with you. Man, that's lovely. I think we're probably living in an era where we're not gaining ground on this. I heard somebody describe a freshman university experience the other day as a party that they were at, as a room that was filled with people that probably had 200 plus friends on Facebook, but had no idea how to have a face-to-face conversation with anyone in the room. I think having, you know, virtual friends doesn't do that much to equip us to have face-to-face conversations, and without face-to-face conversations, the word friend just doesn't have its full dimensions. That's a topic for another day. We'll leave that there. But I have this memory of my first meal in the dining room when I left home in 11th grade to go to boarding school, a situation where I literally didn't know anyone. And I was and am a shy person. And I just looked for a table in the corner, you know, took my meal, went and sat down by myself. I didn't want to be by myself, but I didn't know how to be with anyone else. I was doing my best. And then this guy came and he sat down beside me, and as it turned out, as I got to know him, he came and sat down beside me because he saw that I was sitting alone. And that's very lovely. And sat down beside me and proceeded to show me how to take the core out of an apple with a knife in a way that left the whole rest of the apple intact, which I still do. And he initiated a friendship with me that lasted all the way through high school, all the way through college, and beyond that until people moved to different countries. Awesome. I mean, that was a long time ago. And if that building still existed, and it doesn't, I could take you to that table. Pretty important experience. I want us to go into a story tonight that's going to provide a framework for this occasional series about exploring what makes it hard to believe in our time. And the story is from Mark chapter 9. And Jesus, in this story, has just come down from what the text, the editors have called the Mount of Configuration. There's this wacky thing that's happened on this hilltop. Peter, James, and John, some of his followers have been there. And John tells us that they beheld his glory, glory as the only Son from the Father. Now, they've seen Jesus walking around with Elijah, Moses. It's a wild spiritual story. And Jesus and all these guys, they're kind of glowing. They kind of look like Gandalf the White. Everything's, you know. Our English translation says, wearing garments that were whiter than anyone could bleach them. What an interesting grasping for a description, eh? And it's been sort of an overwhelming experience for them, because Peter, who isn't exactly usually at a loss for something to do, Peter starts babbling about putting up tents. And in the Gospel of Mark, Mark describes what's going on by saying that Peter's talking about that because, quote, he didn't know what to say because he was so frightened. So he just, like, blah, right? He just goes off. So whatever this experience was, they've had this wild spiritual encounter. And then they come down the hill and from this literal high, and they're plunged right into the middle of a controversy. And it just seems like, I don't know if you read the story of Jesus' life, it just seems like every day, controversy just followed him around. Everywhere he went, something got stirred up pretty much all the time. And in this instance, what Jesus and Peter and James and John find when they come down from this crazy spiritual experience is they find the rest of his disciples, and they're in the middle of this large crowd, and at the center of the crowd is a group of religious teachers, sort of the established experts. And the contention, the conflict in the situation is between Jesus' disciples and the experts. And the people around, the rest of the mob, are basically a bunch of curious bystanders who've shown up to watch the fireworks, you know, to see what's going to happen, right? I grew up in this rural high school, and where the action was behind the gym, right? And so all somebody had to do was walk past you in the hall and go, fight. And you kind of knew. You just went behind the gym, and that's where the fight would be. It was entertainment, really. There wasn't much going on in town. So that's sort of what's going on here, right? There's a scrap, and the crowd's gathered. And when Jesus approaches, Mark tells us in the story that a group of people, not the whole crowd, but there's this group of people that break away from the crowd, and they run toward Jesus. He hasn't done anything. He hasn't said anything. He's just shown up. And just his presence evokes some kind of reaction from people. Mark says that the people that run toward him are a group of people who are, quote, overwhelmed with wonder. What would that be like, do you think? And you can almost hear, when you read the story, you can almost hear Jesus kind of coming from that experience to this one. You can kind of hear him take a deep breath, kind of like, okay. And then he just wades right in and he says, what are you arguing with them about? What's going on? And somebody in the story in Mark speaks right up and takes responsibility for the conflict. And this is the way Mark writes it down. A man in the crowd answered, teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. And so that's what's causing the immediate conflict. The official teachers of religion are mocking out the followers of Jesus for presuming to hold the power of exorcism and then utterly failing to deliver. That's kind of an interesting conflict, isn't it? And it doesn't take a lot of rocket science to see that since the followers of Jesus are an extension in that culture of Jesus himself, they're the people who do things like he does, that by relationship, by implication, Jesus is now teetering on the brink of losing credibility, of being a failure. And so there's quite a bit at stake here, and the crowd is watching very, very closely because now the guru is in the room. Now the master is in the room. For the underlings to kind of not quite get the ritual right, whatever the problem was, that's understandable. You know, it doesn't reflect well on the master, but, you know, they're beginners. But, you know, he is the guy. He taught them, and they blew it. And so maybe this whole thing's just a charade. It's just, right? We could, hey Brent, we could pause right there and say, who hasn't had that experience around being a person of faith, being a religious person, if you want, being a follower of Jesus, where something gets promised and not delivered and the whole enterprise gets called into question? We'll come back to that in a little bit. From the religious leader's point of view, this conflict is not a little matter because Jesus is not a big fan of the religious institutions of his time. In fact, he kind of seems to reserve his most unique ire for the people who say that they are there to lead other people toward God, but who are actually serving themselves in this system that does very well for them, but not so great for everybody else. And so these guys, the religious leaders, know that. And they don't really care how they discredit this whole enterprise. If they can discredit Jesus at any point, he loses credibility at every point. So this is a rather important moment. This is not an unusual critique, is it? It's not that hard for us to make a bit of a cultural translation here. If we want to discredit or not consider fully any particular point of view, probably one of the simplest ways, to do that is to find a follower of that way, that belief, that political party, that institution, that point of view, who is an egregious failure, point to their failure, and dismiss the whole matter out of hand. And so that's kind of what we got going on here. And you can feel the crowd holding its breath. You can at least when I read it, I just feel like everybody's just kind of, what's going to happen? And Jesus' response is completely remarkable. I mean, there's a lot of options here, right? And this is what happens. So you have to remember, again, his personal context. He's just come down from this Mount of Transfiguration. He's had this profound spiritual experience. He's been communing with these great faithful spirits of Moses and Elijah. He's heard this voice from heaven say, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." Like all this wild spiritual stuff. And now he's slammed directly into this situation that's loaded with pain. It's loaded with whatever is going on with this kid, this demonic thing. It's loaded with ignorance. It's loaded with official, formal, empirical conflict. It's full of people that aren't dependable on the one hand and outright hostile on the other. And so that's what he's come into. And he walks in, and this is his response. Listen to this. "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." Emphasis mine. What? This is not warm, fuzzy Jesus. What happened to the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, airbrushed, fan-coming one? It's another translation that says, has Jesus say, "How long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?" And it seems kind of out of character for Jesus to speak like this, and it's hard to know what to make of it. It's not because he just sounds really ticked off. This is not the Jesus that I like to think about if I'm distressed. So if I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of this dad, which I have some empathy for this dad. Wow. I find it worth remembering that we have this core in Christendom, we have this core Christian belief that Jesus is fully God and fully human. This is kind of the nugget of the mystery of Jesus, right? Fully human, fully divine. It's a mystery we seek to understand with all of our heart and all of our mind and all of our strength. That's how the liturgy would have it. This is, and one of the reasons I find that our sacred text is credible as a story about this truth is because it's honest about these kind of moments. And what we have here is one of those fully human, fully divine moments for Jesus. This outburst, I would contend, and I think this is defensible, I would contend that this outburst is a wholehearted expression of the depth of Jesus' loneliness and isolation on earth. I think this is a completely honest expression of what it's like for him to realize that he is not understood. That these people that are with him in this enterprise just don't get it, and they don't understand him, and they can't. And it just hurts like hell. And out it comes. And it's a moment, if you want, it's a moment of mourning. And it's like Jesus makes this statement that sums up all of the laments of the prophets, and it sums up the lament of God, the Father himself. It's not a time-bound lament. It's like it's a lament for all time and for all people. It's like we hear Jesus trying to find a way to say, how am I supposed to endure the rejection of my love? How am I supposed to live in this moment where I have poured out and poured out and poured out, and now I can see clearly that these people are not going to be the channel for my love and my power? They're not going to do it. It's not a cry for pity. I think it's more like an honest window into the essence of Jesus' suffering. And I think the reason it has so much agony in it and so much force, the way it just bursts out in the story, is because what Jesus has been working for with these close friends all the way along is to help them get far enough so that they can be channels for his power and for his love. This is, if you want, the dream of Jesus. And it's just getting a real beating in this moment. And it really hurts. And so whatever else is going on, the story shows us Jesus' action. And what his action seems to suggest is that he has this moment where he realizes that whatever needs to be done in this situation, he's going to have to do it alone. And so he shoulders the burden and he says, bring the boy to me. Now what happens if we switch our point of view a little bit and we think about this moment from the vantage point of the boy's father? The father has shown up with his son, and most of the scholars in the realm would say that's whatever's happening to this boy is, by description, classic epilepsy. But it's very intriguing that I won't make much of this tonight, but it's an interesting study how when Jesus addresses the dilemma, the expression of the dilemma, the symptoms, he doesn't address the boy. So whatever is happening and however it's exhibiting itself, when Jesus addresses that, he addresses something external, something ego-separated from the boy. Can work on that. Work on that over coffee. Jesus is, this boy's father has shown up with hope. He's heard about Jesus. He's heard about his followers. He's heard about people being healed. He's showed up with his kid who has this unbelievable dilemma. And the followers of Jesus have said they can heal him. And they haven't. And it's not that they haven't tried. They've tried and failed. I heard somebody this past week describe what it means to overdrive your headlights. And the context was actually a musical adjudicator commentating on a young classical guitarist's technique and the tempo they'd chosen for a certain performance. We live in the country, so we're driving in the dark all the time. There's deer all over the place. And they have this alarming tendency to just park on the shoulder of the road, and once they see your lights, I don't know, it's a magnet, and they just off out of the ditch at the last minute. So you get this, it's really exciting. And what overdriving your headlights means is driving faster than you could handle in terms of stopping or reacting anything that came within the range of your headlights. That's basically what overdriving your headlights means. Can mean lots of things as a metaphor, but that's the actual literal thing. And it's like, in this situation, the disciples overdrove their headlights, right? Like, they just reached for more than they could grasp. My grandfather, my mom's dad, long since passed away, but he was the master of the folk aphorism, the folk saying. And he just had endless amounts of them. If any of us ever left any food on our plate, it was like, looks like his eyes were bigger than his belly. That was his way of saying we saw and took more than we could eat. Same thing. It's like the disciples overdrove their headlights, and the result in this dad is that whatever hope he came with has been mostly shattered. And it's an interesting part of the story. We're not going to get into it too much this evening, but it strikes me when I read this story that there's been a lot of overdriving the headlights that's happened in modern Christendom. Lots of us have grown up with promises of healing, promises of wealth, promises of some kind of Western North American version of success and comfort, some promise of flawless community, promise of some programmatic way in which if we just practice it well, we will unfailingly hear from God. And discovered that the promise makers were overdriving their headlights. And it hasn't happened. And when we're seeking faith, we come into these overblown offerings, and we come into them complete with our sufferings and with our questions and with our trials and with our mysteries and with our hope on our sleeve. And then we find ourselves shattered when the followers of Jesus don't deliver the goods. And we're left, and we're still on the ground. We're still foaming and thrashing around. We're still in the throes of guilt or defeat or illness or broken relationship or whatever we brought in. And the problem is that, like the father in the story, we find ourselves with our challenge intact, but our hope almost destroyed. And that's where he's living. And so what happens in the story is revealing, because even though the father doesn't have much hope left, and we can hear that when he says to Jesus, if you can do anything, have pity on us and help us. Even though the suffering man and his beleaguered son's life are just hanging by a thread, each in their own way, and even though there appears to be reason to doubt that Jesus can do anything, this man, and this is, I think, the most instructive moment in the story, when it comes to the question of what it means to wrestle with belief, this man does the only thing that actually can be done. And what he does is he tosses himself on the mercy of God. And when he does, two things happen in this story. And the first one is that there is this moment of connection between this man and Jesus. I've said it a million times, maybe. I don't know what the number actually is. Lots and lots. I'll keep saying it because I believe it is so important. If we read these stories without imagination, we're done. You have to try to, we have to try to be in the story. And in my mind, this moment between Jesus and this guy is one of, we've all had them in some context or other, but there's a moment where it just, they see one another. And it's just, something happens between them. There's a connection. And it's not tangible, demonstrable, but it's real. They both know. Jesus has this child in front of him on the ground, suffering. And he looks up from this thrashing, suffering son into the helpless and bewildered eyes of this dad. And he repeats his own words to him. It's like he's dragging it out. He says, "If I can do anything, if I can do anything." How does he say it? If I can do anything. What's the inflection? We don't know. That's our work. And then he says, he gives the guy's words back, and then he tags that sentence with one of those statements that takes our breath away and leaves us absolutely bewildered at the same time. He says, "All things are possible to him who believes." And then he commands the demon to come out, which it does, and it leaves the boy lying there looking dead. Okay. Believes what? What is this? Believes that all things are possible? All things are possible to those who believe that all things are possible? All things are possible to those that believe in faith healing? How much do you have to believe? Well, enough so it works, right? All things are possible to those that believe in belief? What? What's he talking about? Okay, so the scholars have had a field day with this moment, as you can imagine in the text, but there is some collective agreement at this point. The agreement is almost negative, and you could tell it this way if you want, that if there's an agreement among scholars, biblical scholars, that the big brains of the operation, about what Jesus is pointing to here, it's more about what he's not pointing to. Almost everyone agrees that Jesus is not here pointing to those that give assent to any particular theological proposition. He's not saying, if you believe this, anything's possible. He's not pointing to those that agree with some religious principle. He's not pointing to those who acquiesce to some spiritual program. What Jesus is pointing to here is way more radical and way more transportable than that. What he's pointing to here is the crazy idea that we could actually trust God's own self as found in Christ. Full stop. What he's pointing to is this belief in the one that Paul writes it this way in Romans 4:17, where he describes Jesus this way. He says, God is the one that calls into existence the things that do not exist. There's a little conundrum. And we should say that if God is the one who calls into existence the things that do not exist, that also includes faith. That if faith comes from somewhere, improbable, impossible, the very best unlikely, it comes from God. Which might sound like a dead obvious religious idea until you spend some time with it. At which point, at least for me, I start to experience a sense of relief and renewed hope. It's important to realize that Mark, the guy who's writing this, Mark's the leader of a group of followers of Jesus, and this group of followers at the time when Mark is writing are facing the real possibility of being persecuted and just outright killed because they have declared that Jesus is Christ, is the Messiah, that he's God. And Mark, when he's writing, knows that most people in this age, like most people in our age, are not going to place their trust in Jesus. And he knows, looking at his little congregation, if Mark's church was packed, it probably wouldn't have been this many people. He knows that most people in this little community that he leads would look at it and say, it's got no future. And he knows that most people faced with an incurable illness will say it's hopeless, and that most people faced with a corpse will say he's dead. And that is why the words that Mark uses to describe the way Jesus heals the boy are so important. Listen to this. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. The crowd was already ready to mourn. As far as they were concerned, the party was over. It was time to go home. Leave the bewildered father with his now not ill, but dead son. Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. And it's Mark's way of telling us that the situation where the power of God is most likely to be thwarted in our human experience, which is the situation of death, is precisely the point at which the power of God that we see at work in resurrection makes itself real and visible to those that believe. I was working on preparing this at home this morning, and the phone rang, and I took the call, and it was the hospice where Corrine's mom is staying. And she is showing signs of what may well be her final decline in health. Corrine is there now, in this instant. Family are flying in tonight. I dropped my youngest two kids off there before I came here for what will quite possibly be, who can say, but it wouldn't be unreasonable to think that these will be their last moments with Granny. So, phone call came, we processed that a little bit, and we all sat around the dining room table, everyone was home, and talked for a bit about what it means that this is a beginning, which Taya subsequently made a card of that she read to her Granny tonight. This is not the end, this is the beginning. Yeah, get out of that intact. Anyway, it's not the goal. The conversation was really interesting because although it wasn't in denial of the pain of this, because this is painful, there were lots of tears. Tyrion's were dripping off the end of his nose. This is grievous. There was lots of tears. There will be plenty of tears. This is not about holding sadness in abeyance. But it is an affirmation of what this story is offering us to learn about, what this story is offering us a chance to just lean into with all of our being. We need to continue to learn that in the retelling of this story and the bringing of this story and other stories from our sacred texts to the challenges of life, we need to continue to learn that when we do that, what we're doing is we're arranging a meeting between God and us. That's why we keep going back into the stories. We keep going back into the stories to make meeting places. We keep going back into the stories to make sacred space, to make a place to be with God. The stories aren't there to offer us propositions. They're not there to offer us some kind of cultural guidelines, which we then spend all of our lives wrestling to transliterate into the 21st century and into our dilemma. They're there to offer us an occasion to be with God and to know God in that kind of story. That kind of story is the same kind of story we live in. I hope, perhaps against reason, I hope to never be where that father in that story finds himself. But I know what it feels like to wonder just for an instant if your child is alive or dead. I've been there. I don't care if I'm never there again. That's horrendous. But this story is about that for me. And in this story, I have occasion to have an arranged meeting, a context given to me by this narrative in which I can meet with God about this kind of thing. Say, who is God in this story anyway? And how does that bring me hope? And what does it teach me about how to be like Jesus in those kind of stories? And God has, this very evening, come forward once again to meet with us. In this story, in the bread and the wine that we're going to share shortly, which is also a drama, also a story. And now, having arranged the meeting and come to it, it's out of our hands. See, the only person in this story in Mark with perfect faith is Jesus. And when Jesus says all things are possible to him who believes, there's a sense in which he's speaking of himself first. And it's his faithfulness in this story that brings God into all the rest of it. And it's his faithfulness by which we receive any faith that we have. That's the part of the story about which we can be completely confident. And about that outburst, how long am I to bear with you? I'm not neglecting that. I just wanted to save it for the end because it's so lovely. See, we know something now about the answer to that question. We know something about the rhetoric of that question. How long did Jesus bear with us? Well, to the end, right? To the absolute limit, as we would understand it as human beings, to death. That's the end. So the answer to the question, how long am I to bear with you, is to the end. And one of the things that this tells us, Isaiah hinted about this a long time before Christ came. He hinted at it when he told us that the one sent from God would bear our griefs and carry our sorrows. Paul wrote about it in Corinthians when he said, love bears all things. God's not waiting around for us. And this question of why it's so hard to believe and what challenges belief in our age, God's not waiting around for us to figure it out. That's not what's going on. He's not laying back, observing to see if we have enough faith, if we've measured some objective mark. And he's not withholding his approval pending our successful application for a life of faith. It's just not the way God operates, because it doesn't matter in that regard how troubling our doubts are. It doesn't matter if we feel inadequate compared to somebody else. It doesn't matter if we feel lost in the challenges of belief. It doesn't matter how often we feel like we're going through the motions. We couldn't do any of this. We wouldn't care to do any of this if there wasn't a germ of faith in us. But there is. And that germ of faith is a gift from God already at work in us. And that is enough. We no longer need to say, we never need to say, again, I wish I had more faith. And instead, what we have is we have the privilege of praying infinitely. Unlimited repeats. We have the privilege of praying, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. The prayer of the Father in the story in Mark. And when we pray that prayer, we have the privilege of wrestling to believe that when the time is right, God will speak the word that will send the doubt and the suffering away, and that he will take us by the hand, and he will lift us up fully alive. This is a mystery which we seek to understand with all of our heart, all of our mind, all of our strength. Amen.